Sunday school. I apologize. This isn't necessarily preaching. I don't feel it's preaching. It's, I don't know if you know what a TED Talk is. If I can give a TED Talk later tonight, some of the things we're going to talk about. And let's go ahead and read this passage in 1 Peter chapter 2, and we'll get into a few things here. In 1 Peter chapter 2, Peter's writing to believers, verse number 6. He says, "Wherefore also it is contained in the Scripture, Behold, I lay in Zion a chief cornerstone, elect, precious, and he that believeth on him shall not be confounded. Unto you therefore which believe, he is precious. But unto them which be disobedient, the stone which the builders disallowed, the same is made the head of the corner, a stone of stumbling, a rock of offense, even to them which stumble at the word, being disobedient, whereunto also they were appointed." Peter's dealing with this issue of how people see Jesus Christ. There's people in the world today that see Jesus Christ as something that we just trip over from time to time. A stone of stumbling, a rock of offense, the Bible says. But to us that know Jesus Christ, we understand that He's the most precious. And He's the very, ought to be at least, the very center of what we build our life all around. And then he goes on here, because of these drastic differences in our outlook in life, verse number 9, he goes on, he says, "But ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, and holy nation, a peculiar people, that ye should show forth the praises of Him who hath called you out of darkness and into His marvelous light, which in time past you were not a people, but are now people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation." In these verses, it talks about us as Christians, as believers, being a peculiar people. We joke about that sometimes. But really, it is a very true assessment. We are different from the world that is around us. We have a different set of values. We have different things that we hold dear that this world doesn't necessarily care for even. The Bible talks about us being strangers and pilgrims. Kind of like we don't fit in. And one of the things, when you go overseas, you come in contact with a different culture. And that culture begins to teach you a lot about who you were to begin with. A culture we talked about in Sunday school the last couple of weeks, about a worldview or about a culture. Basically, I looked it up this afternoon just to give a better definition than I would have given by myself. Culture is a way of life of a group of people, the behaviors, beliefs, values, and symbols that they accept, generally without thinking about them. And they are passed along by communication and imitation from one generation to the next. So culture is a group of things that we hold dear for one reason or another, something that we don't really even think about. And I know it's uncomfortable for us, but I'm going to encourage you to think about a few things here tonight about our own culture. Understand this, that not just nations have cultures. Families have cultures. Church families have cultures. Businesses have cultures. This is something that any group of people has certain values, has certain things that they hold dear, things that are characteristic of who they are. I'm going to hopefully make you at least a little bit uncomfortable, maybe a little paranoid and self-conscious. Okay, that's the goal, all right? And then at the end I'm going to tell you don't be so self-conscious, but that's how you help somebody be self-conscious, right? Okay? But I want you to think about, take maybe a step outside and look in a little bit at some different things. We've been talking about sharing the gospel. Sorry, this is a bumpy road. You can't tell from the picture, but it is a bumpy road. Okay? And so we're talking about bumps on the road to clarity. Understand this, that again, as we've been talking about in Sunday school the last couple of weeks, that the goal as we evangelize, as we talk to others about Jesus Christ, is clarity. The goal of evangelism is to clearly present the gospel so that the hearer can make an informed decision. We want people to know the truth, not just in a way that we're twisting their arm to make a decision, but that they understand what it is that they're being believing. And we talked about this a little bit, and I'm going to give you a few things at the end of the service here tonight that are maybe a little more preachy after we go through all the stuff that makes you self-conscious, okay? But talking about our culture, within independent fundamental Baptist churches, we have a culture. One of the ways that you understand a culture, one of the first things, defining things about a culture, is the language that they speak, the things that they say, and what those things mean. We speak with idioms sometimes. I can think of a good example off the top of my head. I should have broken some of them down, okay? But we say things that aren't necessarily literal, but they mean something to us. Letting the cat out of the bag. Is that an idiom? I don't know. Okay? If you have a cat in the bag, you should always throw the bag in the ocean or the river or something like that. You never let the cat out. But that's a different subject. Sorry, Miss Janelle. Sorry for other cat lovers in here. I met people that said they were allergic to cats. They asked me if I was. I said, I don't know. I didn't taste it. How do we get there? I don't know. Okay? Idioms. We have idioms that aren't literal things. And we understand this about a group of people, the way that we speak. It may be something as simple as the language that we speak, whether we speak English or whether we speak Spanish. I'm sure the Raritans could give us many examples of things in Spanish that people say that aren't literally what they mean, but it has specific meaning to them. Okay, English is the same way. Portuguese is the same way. To me, sometimes I still get very confused when people say things that, you know, it's instead of it's not my cup of tea, not my beach, is how they say it in Spanish. You know, care for, it's not my beach. Okay. Whatever that means, I don't know. First time I heard that, I just, the guy that said it. But, anyways, sorry, I'm getting off track here. The goal of evangelism is to clearly present the gospel so that hearers can make an informed decision. Remember Connor? Remembers the hand motions for that people's reactions ought to be that I get it, that that's for me, and how's the last one? I won't let it go. Right? We even had hand motions in Sunday school. It was a great class last week. All right? But there are certain things that come along the road, sort of, as we're trying to clearly present biblical truths that get in our way that we don't always know. And a lot of it is our culture. Things that we've come to know, come to understand, come to embrace as Bible-believing Christians, as people like myself that have grown up in church since my earliest memories are literally things that happen in church. And that's a good thing. But with it also comes kind of a misunderstanding of people that don't have the same experience. And so if our goal is to be clear, there's certain bumps on the road that we deal with. The first one I have on here is unclear terminology. I'm going to kind of go through these first. I want to go through all of it quickly, but I'm not going to make any promises. Okay, we have unclear terminology, things that we say that maybe doesn't mean the same to us as it means to other people. And so I have a big long list here. I'm going to overwhelm you with a big list. But things that we say sometimes, synonyms or phrases that we say describing our salvation. Salvation is well, look at some of these. Oh, wait. Understand the many, slide ahead of myself, many synonyms and metaphors we use for salvation, and here they are. Okay? We use these oftentimes, some of them less common than others. Some of them maybe aren't exactly doctrinally accurate. Okay, I've lost everybody right now, so I'm trying to read all the words on the screen. Can everybody read them? Are they big enough? Yeah. Okay. There's too many words, so Alex already gave up, right? He just kind of glanced up there. Yeah, it's a lot of words. Okay? We talk about accepting Christ. We talk about asking Jesus to save us, being baptized with the Holy Ghost, and then the person used that one talking about salvation, but
You could, probably.
Okay, be born again, to be converted, to be washed in the blood. Now imagine this, somebody that didn't grow up in your Baptist culture, and you went up to them and said, have you been washed in the blood? What do you think they would say? What in the world are you talking about? We used to joke with my mom one time, we were out soul winning, which is another term. She already knows what I'm saying. She was talking to somebody and just, you know, we're a Baptist church. Well, what do Baptist churches believe? Well, we believe the Bible and, you know, nothing crazy, and she just kind of set it off the cuff. We don't sacrifice chickens or anything, you know, and just, you know, I don't know, people might have questions about that. I don't know, what are you washing people in, what kind of blood or something here, okay? But confessing Jesus as Lord, confessing your sins, crying out to God to be saved, just kind of breezing through some of these, I can give you a full list later, all right? We talk about praying a prayer, obeying the gospel, preparing to meet God, receiving Jesus, receiving the gift of salvation. Now, are these phrases bad phrases? No. But is there some room for confusion with some of these around here? If we don't explain ourselves clearly, is there the possibility that somebody would get confused over what we're talking about in salvation? Is there a possibility that maybe they would think there's a list of these things? You know, maybe there's three or four that I have to do to be saved. Well, you know, I gotta ask Jesus into my heart. I got to be washed in the blood, and I have to, you know, do this and do this and this, and how do I do these things? I don't know. And because we use all of these different terminology, all this different terminology sometimes, it becomes confusing. You see, as missionaries, we talk about cross-cultural communication. How I would say something in my normal home culture versus the culture that I live in. Understand that every one of us as Christians deal with this type of communication. That sometimes those wires get crossed, and those words that you say that mean so much or seem so clear to you aren't always received the same way that you intended them to be received. Everybody understand, okay? Husbands, you're married to a wife, you speak to your wife, okay? She doesn't always understand the words you were saying. Wives, you speak to your husband. They usually have their husband ears on and they don't hear it the first time anyways. And even when you repeat it, they still don't understand. Okay? Basic breakdowns in communication. All communication has the possibility of being misunderstood. We all say yes, right? Been there, done that. Don't have the t-shirt, but if there was a t-shirt, what I would have it. Okay? So are these statements unbiblical? No. Maybe. Some of them, maybe they are, okay? But there's not necessarily that these are wrong, but is there the possibility that they could be misunderstood? As the famous theologian Richard Ricardo once said, you have lots of explaining to do, okay? But as Christians, oftentimes we take for granted that people understand what it is we're saying because, you know, we're using biblical terminology. Well, the world doesn't speak biblical terminology. Do they need to learn it? Yeah, I think it would help them. But maybe there's some explanation that needs to go along with that. Okay? All hearts and minds clear before we move on here. All right? We're going to move on. See what my next slide is. It's a surprise to me, too. The next bump on the road is insider language. How many of you work a job? Okay. Very good. I know you go to work, but you're not raising your hand. I don't know what you do at work. You don't work a job. Go collect. Tell me if you collect a check. No, I won't. But within your company, within your work environment, there's a certain culture. There's things that you would say at your place of employment that if you were to say them somewhere else, they would not understand. Within your profession, if you're a mechanic, you use certain things and, you know, say certain things. Other people that are in whatever other industry, whatever other profession, they wouldn't necessarily understand. Why? Because that's sort of your language. Okay? Somebody who's the computer savvy person, I'm not. That's why I have an Apple. Okay? Because I'm not smart enough to run the other stuff. But somebody that's in that realm you get a couple, a couple people that are geeky about that a little bit in the room talking to each other, and it's just kind of funny to watch sometimes because they speak each other's language, okay? You get a couple mechanics together, and you can watch them talk about this and that and the other, and if you're not in that realm, if you don't understand what they're talking about, you just kind of stand there. These guys know what each other's saying, but I have no idea. I mean, if you have that experience, okay? Been there, done that too, all right? There's insider language. There's things that we say that don't necessarily mean anything to other people. As a missionary, we talk about lots of different things that don't make sense to a lot of people. Not that we're smarter than other people, but we talk about, I could talk with Brother Raritan. I didn't know he was coming. Thanks for coming. Work yourself into the message too. Okay, we could talk about syncretism. We could talk about culture shock, culture stress. We could talk about contextualization, right? We could talk about, some people talk about an incarnational ministry. Say, I don't know what that is. We talk about ethnocentrism. We could have a whole big long list of stuff. Okay, if you're kind of the linguistic nerd along with being a missionary, you would talk about the phonetics and the phonemics and, you know, glottal stops and whatever else your language might have and all this sort of thing. And you would have these areas, but that doesn't mean much to anyone else, does it? Outside of that realm, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. And that insider language can be a good thing. It can bring clarity. It can, within that group, it's a helpful, unifying thing many times to have that language to express these different things. But for somebody who's not in that profession, that's not in that group of people, it becomes very confusing. I'm going to show you a video here in just a second. Every group has their own insider language. Sorry, I already talked about that. All right, now this is a very important video. If you don't get anything else from the sermon tonight, you don't have to forget this. If you forget it, don't forget anything else, all right? But how many of you are mechanically inclined? Okay. Mr. Rex is, obviously, we ask him all of our mechanical questions, right? But for those mechanically inclined, you'll enjoy this video. That was enlightening, wasn't it? Okay, now in that video, he started off, we understood the first 4 seconds or so, maybe. All right? But then he started going into all these things that didn't make any sense. Using a bunch of terminology that I don't think makes sense to anybody. Probably the only person that didn't make any sense to is so mechanically inclined here. Okay? and the reverse dingle arms and all this sort of stuff. You know, most of us didn't make it that far. But understand, if you were in a room full, I don't know how that guy spoke without cracking a smile and a serious face here. But understand, if you were in a room full of people that seemed like they were speaking a different language, but it was the same language, but they were speaking in terms that you didn't understand. And how uncomfortable that is. And all of us have this insider language within the church. I have a whole bunch of things on the list here. Consider the following churchy language. I don't know church. It's churchy. Things that we talk about that some of it makes sense, some of it when you think about it, we ask ourselves why we say that to begin with. Okay? We talk about a hedge of protection. What's a hedge of protection? I don't really know. It's something we pray about very often. Okay? We talk about traveling mercies, okay? That people would be safe as they travel. Traveling mercies, I'm not sure exactly how that phrase evolved. We talk about people being lukewarm. Okay? Normally people don't use conversations. It is a biblical word. It's a word that we should use. But anyways, daily devotions maybe has different meaning if you were in the Oriental culture. Devotions, different things. A prayer closet, or unspoken prayer requests. You know, we talk about visitation, about bearing fruit or seeing fruit. About backsliding. I talked about Ben and Andrew. They backslid. Rows, this girl sat in their row, and the bear just came and took the spot for permanence, and now they're just back there. But we talk about a still small voice, hearing a still small voice. Now that's a biblical reference, but not everyone gets it the first time, right? We call each other brother and sister. And nothing wrong with that, but someone who's not used to the lingo, it may be unusual. We have lots of brothers. Now for some of us in the room, we're all related anyways, right? If your last name's Hicks, you're kind of all cousins, aunts, uncles, whatever. But we can also call each other cousins, right? But we talk about prayer warriors. Now, what's a prayer warrior? You have to wear a special hat to be a prayer warrior, and, you know, carry armor as you are fighting in your prayers. We talk about tithes, offerings. You have a sign over there. What's a tithe? Someone who's on the outside. Taxes or something. Okay. We talk about a thorn in the flesh, okay? Or we talk about our cross to bear. Or when the pastor asks us how we're doing, we respond praising Jesus. Okay, that's an envoy thing, I think. We talk about being washed in blood then twice. We talk about revival. We need revival in the church. We're having a revival meeting. Now how does that sound to most people on the outside? What are we reviving here? Just like a healing service on steroids or something here, a revival meeting? We use theological terms sometimes that normal people don't necessarily know, eschatology, hermeneutics, soteriology, and apostolic succession. I don't know how that got off the list, but we use it sometimes too, okay? Words that we use that maybe even some of us aren't familiar with these words, but there's understand that there's language that we use sometimes that other cultures outside of our own culture don't understand. Now, some of these things, as we mentioned, they're biblical terms. And they're biblical terms that need to be taught and that need to be explained. Others of them, maybe not so much, but there's biblical terminology here that needs to be understood. Just for fun, right? Imagine that you're someone that's never been to a Baptist church before. Prayer meeting, someone stands up and says this: I want to ask all the prayer warriors to go to your prayer closets and bring me before the throne of mercy for my unspoken prayer request regarding my thorn in the flesh. What would you think that person's talking about? We don't really know, but it's an uncomfortable thing, and for some reason we have warriors in this church, you know? Or, here's a good one too. We were just having fun at Mom and Dad's house the other day. You can't help many of these things you can do in sentences, okay? At the end of the service, the pastor stands up and says, if you're hearing the still small voice of the Spirit of God speaking to you, lukewarm, backslidden soul, walk the aisle during the invitation. talk to brother so-and-so about your devotional life and your lack of fruit and your soul. Say, now what in the world? It would be just about like listening to this guy rattle off all these terminologies. Okay, first of all, I have a question here. What's an invitation? Why am I walking in aisles? Is this sort of like walking in plank? Is that some sort of pirate ritual that they do in the Baptist church that I didn't know about? Am I, you know, what do we mean? There's lack of fruit. What's soul winning? You know, and there's all of this terminology that we use. And again, it's not that this terminology is wrong, but it's something that we must understand, be aware, as you speak to people, that these things exist. These breakdowns in communication exist. You know, we're having a revival in our church. What does that mean? Don't forget your special Easter offering this Sunday. Now, wait a minute. What do we offer for Easter? I mean, the Old Testament, they offered all these different animals. What's the acceptable animal to offer for Easter? I don't know. Bunnies? Bunnies? Okay. Bring your chocolate covered, whatever, I don't know. Or after church tonight, we have a time of fellowship. Well, what's fellowship? Usually pastors pray for you, but that's what's seen all the time. But fellowship is the word, in fact, and fellowship, the word fellowship, it doesn't really translate into Portuguese. I don't know if there's a word for it in Spanish that's kind of like translation, but it's kind of funny if you ever come to come to Cape Verde and have me translate for you and you use the word fellowship, I'll probably kick you because it's not like a good way, and not in one word anyways, to translate that word. The best we have is communion. That has other uses too. But anyways, understand that as we deal with this cross-cultural communication, there's always going to be confusion. And we ought to be aware that these things exist. Now, this doesn't mean that every time you use one of these words or one of these phrases, you have to stop and give the 5-minute explanation about what you're talking about. But understand that there's going to be people that misunderstand. When a visitor walks into church, one of the most, and I have a little bit of experience with this, being on deputation and furlough, one of the most weird things is showing up in a church and having nobody there to give you directions, nobody there to tell you what's going on. Who's the pastor? I don't know. I think that's him. There's been churches we've been at on deputation and even on furlough, been back to the same church. And we leave the church and I ask my wife, I say, do you know who the pastor's wife was there? No, we don't know. You know, it's not even a big church. Well, he was talking to this woman. That might have been his wife. No, I think that was the wife of this person. Just, you don't know because nobody tells you. And understand it can be a very uncomfortable thing, especially when somebody comes and visits the church, that they're excluded in all of these things, that they don't understand what's going on. Be a friend to them. Be a translator for them, explaining what's going on sometimes. Not that you have to sit next to them and interrupt everything the pastor says, you know, every time he says something about being a prayer warrior, maybe that would be his explanation, I don't know, okay, or whatever, but understand that there's going to be a breakdown in communication. It's maybe their first. Maybe the first time they've heard these different phrases. And so these are things that we must understand. Bumps on the road to clarity. Okay. Be aware. Basically, I say all of that to make you a little bit self-conscious and say this. Be aware that these misunderstandings exist. And because of that, we need to exercise patience with people that don't understand these things as well as we do. And exercise discernment as well. Be aware of the words we use. Your words have meaning. And we're going to go on from this and talk about something that not only do we don't just need to be aware that this exists, but it's something that we need to avoid, I believe, completely. And that is us versus them language. Within a group, so when you adjust to a new culture, first things you're introduced to is all of these things that don't seem to match up. You know, the unclear terminology that people use, the insider language that you don't understand. And eventually you're tempted to develop this attitude that somehow we're better than them. And, you know, in the United States, we don't wait in line like this. In the United States, when we go to the bank, we can go in there and maybe we wait for one person, but then we're up. here in Cape Verde, or probably in Mexico, you go to the bank to make a simple deposit, and it's waiting for an hour in line. We don't do that in America. America's better than us. You go to the store to buy lumber or hardware or anything like that, it's always this big, complex thing. And you're tempted to get this bad attitude about where you're living that they just don't understand. They need to get their act together. We just pulled the book off the shelf in the library the other day, and we were laughing as we went through it. It's about African Friends and Money Matters. It's a book that I read before we went to Cape Verde, and I remember reading it in the different mindsets of these people that they were talking about. I thought, who even thinks like this? Surely people don't really act this way. We pulled it off the shelf last night, and Tina was just laughing out loud about this. Like, what's so funny? She's like, this is so true. People do this. You buy something from somebody and they never have change. They're selling stuff on the street and they don't have change for the stuff that they're selling. And you're tempted to say, well, they're lying. Sometimes they are. They want to just keep the change themselves. Or other times it's really they don't have change. You go to the store and if you were to bring a big sack of change and pay for your groceries with $20 of coins, instead of being angry about that, they would be really happy because they need the coins to get the change. Now flip that around. If you go to Walmart here, first of all, if you're not talking to the machine, it's weird, okay? But you actually get a person, you wait in line. Imagine going up there and saying, I bought, you know, $20 of stuff at Walmart, which is basically the cost of admission to go into Walmart. But you go up there and you say, here's my $20, and you plop your piggy bank. What are they going to do? They'll smile and they'll say, oh, thank you for bringing in your nickels and dimes for me. Right? Is that what they'll say? No, they'll grumble about it. And if anything, they'll even, you know, there's coin shortages going around. They still probably wouldn't take those coins, right? Because they don't want to deal with it. But it's a different mindset. And so we say, well, this is better than that, or this is, you know, we're better than them. Well, within independent fundamental Baptist churches, we develop this mindset. And there's always the people that are in the in-group and all of those other people outside. And I want to encourage you to avoid this as you speak about those who you live around. Now, we have to make this distinction. There is a difference, and we understand there's a difference. But you see, what I mean by this us versus them language, let's just run down through these. First of all, it's speaking disdainfully of outsiders, those that believe differently than you. Okay, obviously, we believe what we think is true. Right? Someone who disagrees with us is because they believe something that we do not think is true. Simple, right? Does that make us better than them? Not necessarily. Sometimes, it just happens sometimes those people that believe different than us are actually kind of better, more fun people than we are. They don't have that chip on their shoulder, right? But don't fall into this trap, you know. And in a culture, living in a foreign culture, it's this, you know. Well, people here, they do all this stuff backwards. Well, back in America, we do it better, more efficiently, and all that stuff. It's marginalizing the beliefs of those who pushing them off to the side and saying their beliefs, their worldview, their culture, all of that doesn't make any sense. They're just wrong. We live in a culture, in a society in the United States that everything has to be black and white. Everything has to be completely right, completely wrong. You're either totally for this or you're totally against it. And we've done that even within our culture. I'm not talking about doctrinal things and things that we ought to be hard-nosed about, but understand that there is some wiggle room in some areas. We don't have the corner on the market of everything that's good and holy, okay? But understand this, we don't just push people off to the side without listening to what they have to say and understanding where they're coming from, how they came to those beliefs and all that different that we've been talking about in Sunday school and whatnot. We revert to name-calling. We call them this, that, and the other, everything but a white boy. Okay?
listing the order of our children.
Or we'll start sentences with, I despise this person. First of all, you're not God. Right? You don't have the right to despise this person. And if you did, it would always be wrong. Or we'll start a sentence with something like this. I cannot believe that they would ... or that they would say ... or that they would do this or that or the other, or say this or that or the other. I cannot believe that anybody would believe like they believe. How can they, you know, see in the Scripture that this is so true and they deny this and whatever? How can they? Sometimes there is evil that's present, but a lot of times it's just simply they're misinformed. They've never had anybody explain the truth. And when we approach them with this us versus them language, this ready to debate them and call them all the names in the book, you know, it doesn't, this might be me, I'm not even saying it, okay? Moving on. Why is this a problem? Why is this attitude a problem when it exists in our hearts and minds? First of all, very simply, it's a problem because it's a problem on a practical level. Okay? First of all, it's unkind. And secondly, it's self-defeating. You know, if we're trying to draw people to Jesus Christ, but we're doing it by driving wedges over unnecessary things, we have a problem. There's a problem in our strategy here, okay? If I'm putting two pieces of, I'll talk in the terminology I understand, okay? I like woodworking. If I'm putting two pieces together, I'm going to use a clamp and I'm going to have it pushing the two pieces together. I'm not going to set it up so it's pushing away from each other and I'm going to kind of hold it all together. It's working against myself. It's self-defeating. Okay? It's unkind. It's self-defeating. But then more dangerous than this, and the aspect that we ought to be more concerned about, is on a spiritual level, this us versus them language reveals the self-righteous spirit and the lack of understanding of God's grace. It reveals that I have this attitude that I'm obviously better than this person or that person or that group of people. And it reveals also this misunderstanding of God's grace in my own life. It's this sort of victim mentality that we develop, that somehow everyone is gunning for us as we're the most righteous person. We're better than everyone else and thus everyone hates us, and so it's me versus. Or at least, you know, maybe I'm not the most righteous person I know, but I'm exactly like him. You know, God's the most righteous person, but I believe everything exactly like he does. I know everything exactly like he does. And so, you know, they pick a fight with him. Obviously, they're picking a fight with me because I'm equal somehow in my own mind, right? A victim mentality has never really helped anybody, and that's what we've developed many times. We become so energized and defined by the enemies that we've made and the sides that we take. And it comes down to this, that we know all the things that we're against, but we've forgotten what we're doing. When we've forgotten the grace of God, when we've forgotten that we also were unworthy of God's grace, when we've forgotten that we also have no righteousness of our own, and so when we've raised ourselves up and puff ourselves up and say, these people, you know, they're outsiders, they're, you know, they're all backslidden, they're all whatever it may be, whatever the terminology we may use to define these other people and talk about how wicked and ungodly and sinful they are. Understand this, many of those people hold some sort of morals within their life. They're just different than others. And what do we do with them? We blast them out of the water. Moving on, I don't want to get too stuck on that. Be careful about our speech. There's things that we need to be aware that they exist and things that we need to avoid at all costs. And I believe that this is one of them that we must avoid if we're going to genuinely reach people. We've been talking about in Sunday school one of the phrases, beware of these bumps. Here's the blank one. We've been talking about in Sunday school building redemptive relationships. Maybe we threw that phrase out. And I want to just talk very quickly about that. Sorry, Gary. You can get a piece of cake on your way out. he's been forsaken after church. He's got the steak left. But then I thought he could just get a piece. He could take the whole cake if he wants, probably. Now everyone's getting ideas, right? Turn over to Colossians chapter 4 just quickly as we sort of close up this section and we'll move on to something else that'll be much quicker, I promise, okay? Colossians chapter 4, one of the many verses in the Bible that give sort of the same instruction. Verses we read in Sunday school, I think, last week. Verse number 3, Colossians 4 says, "With all praying also for us, that God would open unto us a door of utterance to speak the mystery of Christ, for which I am also in bonds, that I may make it manifest as I ought to speak, walk in wisdom toward them that are without, redeeming the time." Verse number 6, "Let your speech be always with grace, seasoned with salt, that ye may know how ye ought to answer every man." Oftentimes we emphasize the end of that verse, knowing how to answer every man. You know, we're going to tell him what for. And somehow we miss the first part of the verse that says it ought to always be seasoned with grace. As we talk about building redemptive relationships, next slide here, we talk about building redemptive relationships, or as we may call them, truth and grace relationships. Building relationships with people that we are sharing the truth and the grace that we know. In John chapter 1, verse number 14, if you're really quick, you can turn there. I have the marks in my Bible. John 1, verse number 14 says, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory, the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." One of the most interesting things to me that was said about Jesus Christ is this very simple phrase, that He was full of not just truth, but also grace. And you see, in all of our lives, we cannot be full of two different things. There's sort of like a spectrum here. There's some people that, at least they think, they're full of truth, but they possess no grace. Right? Maybe you've met people like that. Or there's the other people that think they have at least some truth, but they're mostly just mushy and full of grace. Right? They'll always say the nice thing, at least in front of your face. Maybe behind your back, they say. But at least to your face, they always have these kind, soft things to say. But Jesus Christ was full of both of these things. He possessed them completely. The verses move on. It talks again about Jesus. Verse number 18, "No man has seen God." Or where was that? Verse number 17, "For the law was given by Moses, but grace and truth came by Jesus Christ." We want to develop relationships with people that are like this, that are full of grace and truth. That we are saying the things that need to be said sometimes, even if they're not readily received. There's a confrontational aspect that has to happen. It's something that's undeniable. We talked about the offense of the gospel, that the gospel to the lost, unregenerate mind is an offensive thing. And so there's going to be that offense. But then we ought to be careful that now we're not causing more offense by our own foolishness. So grace and truth relationships. Just a couple quick things, and I want to point to the life of Christ as we talk about these things. Just very quickly. First thing on the list, how to build personal or how to build redemptive relationships with those that we're around. Relationships that point people to Jesus Christ. It always begins, any spiritual endeavor that we're on always begins with getting our own heart into it, with personal preparation. Jesus, before you go through His life, before He chose His disciples, before any of these major things happened in His life, what do you find Him doing? Almost always, He's somewhere praying. He's somewhere submitting His will to His Father. And you see, before we take any steps forward, we must understand this, first of all, must be real in our own heart and mind. If we're going to point people to Jesus Christ, we ought to be the person that is personally in love with Jesus Christ. Is it real in our own heart and life? It's been said that the best advertisement is a satisfied customer. If you find true fulfillment and happiness in Jesus Christ, you will be talking about it. It's not a drudgery. It's not something that we have to do. It's on my list of Christian duties that I must perform. platform this at least once a week. Talk to somebody about Jesus. Oh, I hate doing that, right? No, it's something that you're so overwhelmed with His love for you and His grace that He's demonstrated in your life that you can't help but speak the things that you've seen and heard as the apostles said that. You remember when they were arrested and beaten, Peter and John, as they're brought before those that would accuse them, and they said, we can't help it. This is, you know, what else are we going to talk about? If we're given the audience, we'll talk about it again. They begin preaching Jesus to those that have them on trial. Why? Because their relationship was so real, so deeply personal, so life-changing, that it was something they had to speak about. And we talk about other things like this all the time. You meet somebody famous. Oh, you'd never guess who I met today. Your brother-in-law gives piano lessons to somebody who's important or famous, right? And we talk about that, right? Everyone knows what I'm talking about, at least all the people that are on the inside. No, okay? But, you know, we've rubbed shoulders with these people, at least by extension somehow. Well, I know somebody that met this person that knows this other person, the dog groomer of this person, my best friend's cousin, or something like that. You know, and we're always bragging about these things. But somehow our relationship with Jesus isn't that way. That we only know the God of the universe that created all things and all that sort of stuff. But we can't speak about that. We're not ready to speak about that. Another part of our personal preparation is creating space in your life. It's not important. Create space in your life. Is there wiggle room in your life that you can develop these relationships? You see, we become so organized and so streamlined in our day. Well, I'm going to go for this, go for this, go for this. And I'm going to get all this stuff accomplished at the end of the day. But we never had time to stop and talk to this person. We never had time to, you know, in our context, in Cape Verde, sometimes you're waiting in line next to somebody for 45 minutes or an hour. Hey, they have nowhere else to go. You might as well start talking to them, right? And we have these opportunities, but sometimes we just don't take them. I was encouraged somewhere along our travels, we met some friends, and they don't believe just like us, and I'm just kind of Baptist, sorry, I have friends that are Baptist. Okay, but they know the Lord, they love the Lord. And they met us on the day, it was a Saturday. I think it was a Saturday, it might not have been a Saturday. But they called that. They say that we began in their own life taking what they call the Sabbath day. This happened to be on Saturday, which was towards the end of the week. But they would have a day set aside in their week where they would just kind of, as I believe, at least in part, the Sabbath day was intended to be a day to step back and to give attention to important things, but different things. And they met us on their Sabbath day. And they began explaining this to us, that they just created sort of the space in their life where, you know what, we have some things to do, but if I'm going to Walmart or I'm going to Home Depot or Lowe's or Walmart or wherever it is I'm going, I'm going to go and I'm not going to be so pressed for time that I can't stop and talk to them. And if I happen to be near somebody, I'm going to start talking to them. And I'm going to take those opportunities and maybe I'll meet somebody along the way that I can be an encouragement. You see, we become so focused and so goal-oriented that we overlook this personal aspect. That gets us to the next part. We'll talk more about that in a second. The next part is initiating conversation. Beginning conversations with people. I think of in the life of Christ, as he talked, of course, Nicodemus came to him. Nicodemus had questions for Jesus, but Jesus didn't talk to him. After dark, I don't know if it was supper time or maybe he was interrupting Jesus with dessert. I don't know. Okay? But he took the time to speak to Nicodemus. Another obvious example is in John chapter 5 where Jesus must needs go through Samaria. We've talked about that before. You've heard the story before where he goes and he sits on this well and this woman comes out and she's there drawing water. He just happens to be there and what does he do? He begins a conversation with her. A conversation that's going to point her to the truth about who Jesus is. He could have been in a hurry. Jesus had things. He had things to teach. He had hundreds, thousands of people that followed him at times, but still, he made sure that there was time in his day that he could take with these people. He could start those conversations. It's showing genuine interest, not just I'm loving them so that I can, whatever, share the gospel with them. No, that's not necessarily it. But we're leaving so that to the Lord. We're not just loving them so that they'll get saved. Maybe that's our goal in our mind, but we're understanding this. First of all, we're loving them. And we're initiating those conversations. And we'll leave the so that up to the Lord. He can do with it what He wants. But we're going to be showing grace to people, initiating this conversation. The next thing is, we see that we're investing relationally. Investment always costs something, right? It's putting something of value in the hands of somebody who may not see that value. Jesus invested in people all throughout His ministry. We see Him investing in people. The example I've written down in my paper is Jesus with Zacchaeus. Don't ask me how to spell Zacchaeus, but I'm looking at it. Obviously, it's not right on my paper here. That's why I didn't put it on the slide, okay? But Jesus was investing in somebody who He was going to get some grief about, okay? All the religious people were saying, Jesus is a friend of sinners. They thought it was an insult. Maybe it was more of a compliment than an insult. I'm glad He's a friend of sinners because I fit that category, right? And here's, maybe that's a good example of that us versus them language. Jesus, He's a friend of sinners. He's not like us. Anyway, He invested in people like Zacchaeus. How many times in Jesus' life do you see Him eating meals in people's houses? And this is, it seems as if the ministry of Christ, as you read through the Gospels, that the majority of His ministry, or at least we could say, pretty safely say at least half of His ministry, was not a public ministry. It was talking to people in more of a private sense. It was, I guess Jesus didn't necessarily have a home to invite people over. He just invited Himself. Hey, that's kind of nice. Kind of like showing up at Todd and Amy's and eating the tacos. Thanks for the invitation. You didn't really invite me, but hey, the taco was good. I still have heartburn from the deep fried shells. But it's investing in people in a relational way, in a way that we can truly become their friend. And then just moving on, the last thing that's pretty obvious is patiently proclaiming. Jesus was somebody who, as He described Himself, was gentle and lowly. He was somebody that was approachable. People didn't feel any inhibitions coming to Jesus and asking Him even the most personal questions. Why was that? I think it reveals something about the personality of our Savior. That He was somebody that was that He was reproachable. They did reproach Him, okay, but He was approachable, that people could come and could speak to Him. And that He would patiently tell people, again, that He is full of grace and truth. Understand this, just sort of wrapping up. Well, here's our phrase that we gave you today, in case you didn't get it written down. Initiate conversations that may become eventual relationships. Begin conversations with this one that can point people to Christ. Understand this, that as we're sharing the gospel message, we're telling a story. There's often times that, you know, you win an argument with somebody and you walk away and say, what did I really gain by that? Nothing. You know, another notch up my gun or something like that. You know, I won this argument. But did we really do what we were told to accomplish? You know, the message is pretty simple. You know, we can summarize the Bible just in a few different words. That, you know, there's the creation, there's the fall, there's the redemptive plan of Jesus Christ, and there's this restoration of all things that's going to happen in the future. And there's, you know, this simple story, and understand this, we're telling people a story. And it's a story that somehow, in God's grand scheme of things, we fit into that story. It's a personal thing. And you see what we've done many times in our outreach to those that are around us, in our what we call evangelism, is we've kind of reduced it to some sort of cheap business hacks, business tactics that we use. No, we become salesmen and political campaigners, sort of. You know, like we're selling used cars or promoting some political campaign, you know, vote for Jesus sort of thing, and, or whatever. We've reduced this to all of these cheap business tactics instead of understanding that we're the message carriers. We're the people that are delivering the message. It's the message of Jesus Christ. Something that made me change the way I thought about this a little while back. I was reading a book, and I don't think it was necessarily even included in the book, but it was just the thought that came to my mind. That as we're telling people about Jesus Christ, I think the author said this, that we're delivering a wedding invitation. Of course, we understand at the end of the Bible that there's this marriage supper of the Lamb. There's all of these things, you know, that we're inviting these people to attend to that wedding. But understand that it's much more. It's a wedding proposal that we're inviting people to. Imagine the importance of the message that we're delivering. That Jesus Christ of this world, of every tribe and kindred and nation, is taking out a people for himself. At that marriage supper of the Lamb, and there's all sorts of different ideas about this, but the idea that I understand from Scripture is very simply this, that bride of Christ is made up of all the believers. And understand this, that those people that we look on with disdain and understand, you know, they're not like us, and they're different than us, they have a different set of beliefs, understand this, that they're also invited to be part. They're also invited to have their place in that table. And we can, you know, be all high and mighty and all self-righteous. But understand this, that we're not just trying to twist people's arms and, you know, catch them in a dark alley and try to get them to pray a prayer or whatever it is. But we're inviting them to be in this group, in this bride of Christ, and these people that will one day spend eternity with our heavenly bride. And we've been called to give this message to them, that you've been invited. Imagine the importance of it. Imagine the ramifications of that. And, you know, we've reduced it to this kind of Mr. Arden to vote for Jesus. But it's a wedding proposal that we're doing. And so the encouragement is very simply this, as we've talked about this in Sunday school. A lot more we could talk about. The cake's that cold. Okay? But understand this, that we've been given the best message. The message that this world needs to hear. I'm not proposing that, you know, some new gimmick or tactic that we need to use, but understand this, that we need to be very intentional about what we're doing. Are we sharing it like we ought to? Are we developing those relationships with those that we come in contact with that we can point them to Jesus Christ? I guess that's the encouragement here tonight. We are a peculiar people, some of us more than others, I suppose. We are strangers and pilgrims. We are living in a place that we don't always fit in. But the reason that we're here isn't just for our own comfort, for our own whatever. It's to point people to Jesus Christ. We have to ask them. We're being faithful. It's entrusted to us. Let's go to the Lord in prayer.